Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 55615, Kearns versus, is it Hoppe?
Yes, Your Honor.
Kearns versus Hoppe. Mr. Ehrlich for the appellant, Mr. Cotton for the respondent. Mr. Ehrlich.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jeffrey Ehrlich for the plaintiffs and the appellants, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'd like to thank
the court for according me the privilege of arguing for you this morning. This is an appeal from an order granting summary judgment in favor of the defendants in a wrongful death malpractice claim. The decedent, Warner Kearns, died of a methadone intoxication on August 23, 2005, 7 days earlier. The medical defendants, the Desert Trails Medical, had given him a prescription of 120 methadone pills in an effort to wean him off of OxyContin. And the prescription told him how much methadone to take each day and told him to follow up as needed. The pharmacy defendants filled the prescription without inquiry into its purpose, and the plaintiffs have sued both for professional negligence. It is not contested that the medical defendants were not certified under federal law to prescribe methadone for addiction treatment, and the pharmacy defendants were not certified under federal law to dispense methadone for addiction treatment.
But the pharmacy was allowed to fill a methadone prescription as a pain medication.
That is correct, Your Honor. So they had in our view, since it would be illegal to fill it for addiction management and legal to do it for pain management, it would be incumbent to comply with the law to determine its purpose before filling it.
So what information did the pharmacy have in its records that made it improper for the pharmacy to fill that prescription?
Well, the first would be the absence of an understanding about what the purpose of the prescription was.
So you would like the pharmacy to have a duty to inquire?
That is correct.
What else?
Our pharmacy experts have said that the fact that they filled the OxyContin prescription 11 days earlier, and also that the methadone was prescribed at a very high dosage, four times a day, were what our experts said were red flags that should have alerted the pharmacy.
The prescription, though, was not contraindicated by anything in the pharmacy's record.
That is correct.
Have you seen our recent Clash decision?
I can't say.
Okay, it bears on the issues on this appeal from the pharmacy defendants. And I was talking to my colleagues about it. We adopt learned intermediary in it in the context of pharmacies, where pharmacies are relying on a doctor's judgment in writing a prescription, but also the exception to it where something in the pharmacy records demonstrates that filling the prescription was contraindicated. So it's a bit of a change in Nevada law that may or may not affect the outcome of this case.
I think the difference
as to the pharmacy defendant.
The difference with respect to the pharmacy defendants here, Your Honor, is when the federal law specifically makes it illegal to fill a methadone prescription for a particular purpose, it would seem that requirement would create a duty to inquire to make sure that you're not filling it for an illegal purpose and you're filling it in accordance.
Do you have any authority on that? Because I thought when we did class, we kind of took a step to further on pharmacies' inquiry if they have certain information, Justice Pickering pointed out. Here, if you have a drug that's legal to be prescribed for pain, methadone here like that, how is there any authority and I understand what you're saying about the OxyContin, you can't mix the two, but is there any authority similar to our Clash case from other jurisdictions that would back your argument up?
Only the fact that it, for the purposes of the summary judgment, it wasn't disputed that there are the federal requirements for how to dispense methadone and that specifically make the pharmacy have a concurrent responsibility to dispense with a physician in accordance with the federal regulation. So if you have a whole scheme of federal regulation as a pharmacy that tells you how you can do it legally, then at a threshold level, then you would have to make, and this is the leap of logic, I understand, but it seems a pretty solid logical foundation.
But do you have cases that say we're going to take that federal regulatory duty and use that as the premise for imposing common law tort liability on a pharmacy?
Well, in a general sense, this court has held.
No, I mean in this context of CFR drug
No. So the defendants, going back to the general claims at issue in the summary judgment here, the defendant's position is that unless the plaintiffs can demonstrate as a part of their case in chief that Mr. Kearns died as a result of the consumption of the prescribed dose, there can be no causation as a matter of law, or if he consumed more, he assumed the risk. And we don't think that for the purposes of summary judgment, either of those defenses is viable. First of all, there's a tribal issue of fact about whether he took a larger dose of methadone or not, that the record doesn't allow that to be decided as a matter of law. The Giortani report that was submitted with the summary judgment says that Dr. Giortani, the toxicologist, says that in light of the medical record, the other evidence that he had asthma, that he was taking the risks of methadone, that Dr. Giortani said that he thought it was probable that he died of respiratory failure as a result of taking a therapeutic dose. So that creates a tribal issue of fact on that issue. But with respect to superseding cause, even if the defendants were right and they were to establish that he took more than he should have, it can't be a superseding cause, because the act of an addict taking more than he's supposed to of an opiate drug, when you're addicted to an opiate drug, is the very act that makes it negligent. That's a foreseeable act, and foreseeable risk can't be a superseding cause.
But how about, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that if you're taking methadone to get off Oxycontin, you know, one opioid for another, you can't be taking the Oxycontin plus the methadone at the same time.
It certainly creates risks with that, with the Xanax, the methadone, the Oxycontin, all evidently work through the same metabolic pathway, and they have additive effects that will suppress respiration and create this risk of dying in your sleep, and that's what happened. And that's what happened here. So I think that where the thing
was, he
that,
getting methadone. I know they didn't recover the bottles, and that's a separate issue. But was the source of methadone only, you know, that's established in this record? Did it only come from the August 16 or whatever the date was prescription by Desert Trails that was filled at Walmart?
That is the only methadone prescription that has been in this time frame that has been filled and that he was taking. So the methadone that he took, the method caused him to die, was the methadone that was prescribed for him and filled by the pharmacy.
And the blood work autopsy established that methadone in his system.
Yes, the cause of death was methadone intoxication. So while I have time, to the assumption of risk, that's not a defense for summary judgment in this matter either. This court's opinion in Turner relies heavily on the Davenport case from South Carolina. Davenport sort of lays out the landscape of assumption of risk very clearly, that you have two general categories of express and implied, and then with implied, two subcategories of primary and secondary. So there's no express basis to say, I don't think that they have a basis to say that the contract that was signed is a formal release and an express assumption of the risk. It's a notice that says, I understand if I engage in certain behaviors, it could be deleterious to me. And their argument is that he was aware that certain behaviors could be illegal or could be harmful to his health. Of interest here, there's no evidence that the drug seeking, the doctor shopping, and getting other pills played a role here. There's no evidence that he died from something. I mean, it's not.
Well, but your argument that the metabolic pathways are the same, if he had other drugs flowing through his veins in greater quantities, then, I mean, I think that's probably fact-bound.
Right. But for the purpose of summary judgment, I think there's no issue of express. With respect to primary assumption, that is a situation where the defendant literally has no duty of care. And usually it's because the parties are engaged in some activity, usually an athletic activity. And so if you're playing softball and you agree to play softball, and you're batting, you don't have a duty of care not to hit the pitcher with the ball, and you don't have a duty not to run into the first baseman. There are all kinds of athletic events or other activities that if you try to impose a duty of care, it would inherently change the nature of the activity, and there's just no duty owed. Here, the medical defendants are professionals that are dispensing drugs. They have a duty of care. So the issue then goes to secondary assumption of the risk, which is whether the defendant, with knowledge, met or engaged in the risk that they created. The risk they created was prescribing the drugs and sort of handing him the 120 pills, a 30-day supply, when due care and proper practice would have been to give him one dose of liquid per day. So they gave the addict a bowlful of drugs, and he took perhaps more than he should have. That would be a comparative fault issue. This court has in the its assumption of risk jurisprudence, as you're aware, said that their secondary assumption in the Musashima case remains subsumed within comparative fault. So with 4 minutes and 23 seconds left, I'd like to reserve that for a
certainly.
Moment. Thank
you. Scotton, for the respondent.
This is a case about choices and consequences. It's full of them for everybody, including the court. The court can take a simple choice here, and that's to look at the causation issue. We never even get to the assumption of risk questions that were just raised. The fact is there aren't any pill bottles. There's no evidence at all where the methadone came from. He had been prescribed methadone back in February and March, the same way it was here, switching over from one pain medication to another, precisely the same way. He didn't use all those medications back then. He was prescribed over onto Norco or OxyContin, one of the two, and it's in the records. He was prescribed more of those at a later date in February and March before he'd even subsumed all of the methadone at that time. I don't know whether he took methadone from this prescription, that prescription, something he got from his father. I don't know. And nobody knows because we don't have the pill bottles. We don't have the pill bottles from the methadone. We don't have the pill bottles from the OxyContin. We don't have the pill bottles from the Xanax. We don't have the pill bottles from anything. And they were in the controlling custodies, presumptively, of either the decedent or, once he died, his wife taking over his estate, had the house and everything in it. They weren't able to produce anything, although there was some testimony about something maybe being in a locked closet in the garage, which nobody pointed the officers out to. But we couldn't prove anything, and their experts said, I cannot state to a reasonable degree a probability that he overdosed, that he took the prescription that was prescribed, that he took it, but I have an opinion it might have been taken in combination with other drugs. Well, the fact is, if you look at the autopsy report by Roxanne Worrell and the drug test that was done as a result of that on the blood, the only thing that shows up in his bloodstream is methadone. It doesn't show up at all for any of the OxyContin or hydrocodone or Xanax, any of those other drugs that they keep referring to as this as poison cocktail they refer to. There's zero evidence that that ever occurred. Now, the practical matter is the consequences the court affirms on the basis of the lack of any competent causation testimony and understand why the expert could not. This case is over at that point. They haven't proven a single thing. If the court isn't
but why isn't the proximity in time between him receiving and, I assume the record establishes he filled the methadone prescription?
Yes.
Correct, the August one. Why isn't the proximity in time and the present his bloodstream of methadone sufficient to create an issue of fact as to your client's prescription having caused this man's death when, according to their experts, issuing that prescription fell below the standard of care in this context?
Well, the only testimony they had was issuing it for purposes solely of withdrawal was a violation. Taking a therapeutic dose for pain relief, which is what Mr. Armitage testified to, and it's uncontroverted that that's what he prescribed it for, there is nothing in the record to show that he took more than he was supposed to. There's nothing in the record to show that he took what he was supposed to.
But isn't there a point that even the therapeutic dose was inappropriate for this man? I mean, they may not win at trial, but isn't that the point of their...
No, their point was that somehow or another my client violated a federal law by trying to withdraw this man on methadone. He testified, I'm getting him off OxyContin and I'm putting him onto methadone. I need to keep his pain relief until we get his knee surgery. That is uncontroverted testimony. It's precisely the change that he did, and you can see it in the records in February and March where he was having a problem with Norco, didn't make him feel right either, and he switched him over from Norco to methadone. You can't switch somebody off a drug that they're not feeling good on and just drop them cold. The pain relief will stop at that point. If the choice is methadone, OxyContin, hydrocodone, whatever the switch might be, you switch over, and all the testimony, uncontroverted, is that methadone is an appropriate pain-relieving drug. it is prescribed and has been since World War II for those sorts of
But they're saying that an asthmatic with who's being weaned off of oxycodone or whatever the drugs were, that those drugs, that first, that those have long half-lives, so they're in the system, and that methadone has a long half-life, so it's a tough thing to monitor. Their point is, as I read their papers, and maybe I'm wrong on this, is that whether he died of a therapeutic dose or of an overdose is immaterial because methadone caused him to go into respiratory failure and die, and that that was predictable and below the standard of care given that he was an asthmatic and formerly addicted to OxyContin or whatever the other...
There really isn't any testimony that asthma is a contraindicator, that you simply can't get methadone. That's not what the PDR says. There are the records in there from the drug manufacturers. It's not, it may be something, as you pointed out, that might have to be watched, but it is not something where you simply do not give the drug in a therapeutic dose for pain relief. It doesn't cover that. As to the assumption of risk, we've got two levels that I think you can argue here. You can argue either an express assumption or the primary implied. The express, he signed a contract with Desert Trails. He said, I will not go get drugs from other people. I know it's against the law. I understand, and here's where the problem runs in, and here's where it's not a comparative fault situation. He knows that if he comes in and says, I'm going to go get more drugs than you're prescribing for me, we cut him off. We don't give him methadone. We don't give him any drugs at that point. I've now, in the last 2 weeks, seen three doctors and have gotten narcotics prescribed by them. Would you give me some methadone or something else? Sorry, you just breached our agreement. That's the agreement we had with him that he breached. He assumed the risk that that breach would take place. He hid that from us so that that breach couldn't be declared. But he assumed that risk knowing that we would cut him off and cut him off from any further narcotics if, in fact, he decided that that was what he was going to do. Now, in terms of the primary implied assumption of risk, if the definition of that is the plaintiff impliedly assumes those risks that are inherent in a particular activity. One of the risks inherent in a particular activity, such as drug seeking or doctor shopping, is that you could become an addict. You could alter your physical being. You could do things harmful to your health. The real risk that you run is that you've now, by lying, cut doctors off, and by breaking the law, too, by the way, a public safety law, you've now deprived the doctors of the ability to stop you because they don't even know what's going on. They want to argue in their briefs, well, the Dr. Armitage should have known he was on all these drugs and stuff. There's three other doctors who prescribed him narcotics in that same period, three other doctors who had drug contracts with him, and he violated each and every one of those. He assumed the risk of an inherently dangerous act, which is to get narcotic medications when you're not supposed to be getting them from multiple doctors, and there's a policy reason behind that, and there's a policy reason behind these drug contracts. You've got to have one doctor overseeing everything so that one person doesn't go out and start smacking up their body with all sorts of different narcotics. I don't know what the condition of his body was by the time he got to the 16th and took methadone from whatever source. But we do know that he was getting two or three other sources disclosed to our clients. And that's the problem.
He was getting methadone from
some? Not methadone. He was getting other narcotic medications, though, from two or three other doctors. Dr. Herr, a P.A. Levasseur, I think her name was, and also from Dr. Holper was also another one that he was getting the drugs from. And in writing, he conceded that was a criminal liability. The problem is if you reject those sorts of contracts and don't put the risk on the plaintiff for violating those contracts and breaking the law, you've basically taken all the teeth out of the contract. You basically said, look, I don't care if you tell the doctor, I don't care if your doctor shop. That's all fine and dandy. You're not taking any risk. The only risk you take is the cotton's going to put the contract in front of somebody at a trial and the jury gets to consider it. That's their theory of what you should do. Our position is that when he assumed that risk, he took the burden off our client. Because when he decided to violate those agreements, that doesn't impose a duty on my client to go running around behind him and making sure as he drives around the town that he's not seeing other doctors. He's the one that put himself at risk. He's the one that took himself off the table, if you will, from a diagnostic standpoint, and I believe at that point in time he has assumed an inherent risk of his conduct, and the court was justified in barring his recovery.
What about the quantity of methadone that was prescribed? The counsel said he was given the prescriptions were for too much.
You know, if you prescribe that medication solely for withdrawal, it might or might not be too much. Mm-hmm. It's a therapeutic dose for pain relief.
So 120, that's what probably, I don't know how what period of time that covers.
It'll be a 30, 40-day period of time. Okay. It's you know, same as OxyContin. So you might get 150 of them over a period of time. But again, you've got to have some evidence that somehow or other, there's no evidence at all anybody thought this guy was addicted to methadone, that he'd overdosed methadone somehow or another. They're different. They all have respiratory qualities and stuff, but they're different drugs. They're not the same drug that this man was being prescribed.
So you're saying, as far as this federal law and the clinic and all that, if your clients weren't aware of it, you're saying it's a red herring, basically.
Out of whole cloth. Just came out of whole cloth. There's nobody who's testified that he was given that drugs for the sole purpose of trying to make him withdraw from any drug and that they were acting as a drug clinic. There, if you want to call it mixed use, there's nothing in the statute that precludes somebody from giving another pain medication like methadone for pain relief, and the consequence of doing that always is that you're going to have the other person, they'd be pulling off of that other drug when they're switching over to methadone, just like if they switch from methadone to OxyContin. Either way, if you want to call that a withdrawal program, that's a pretty far stretch.
On the pharmacy issue, and I'm sure you're getting to it, on our new case that Justice Pickering referenced in the opening argument here, what's your thoughts on the interaction with that case and to the facts of this this appeal here?
Well, based on the case that came down, my read on the flash was that basically the pharmacy has a right to rely upon a learned intermediary's writing of a prescription for a particular purpose that intermediary determines is appropriate for this patient, which Mr. Armitage did in this case. And as a result, I don't think that he was wrong in prescribing it for continued pain relief, and I don't believe the pharmacy was wrong in filling it.
Are you dividing time?
We are. That's why I didn't. Okay. I keep backing up. It's not because I don't like
okay.
You look as if you'd like to leave right now.
Thank you, Your Honors. It's a pleasure to be before you this morning. As Your Honor brought up,
would you state your name, please?
Brenna Ensminger for the respondent pharmacy defendants, or respondents. As Mr. Urlach conceded in his argument, there's absolutely no case law, no authority that provides for tort liability against my clients in this context. Most certainly, this court in the Garrigus case, the Nevada Board of Pharmacy versus Garrigus, proffered that it is not for the pharmacist to second guess a licensed physician's prescription unless something within the four corners of that document, that prescription, shows that it would be obviously fatal. Taking that case and adding to it in the recent Sanchez case, which came down about a year ago, in the Sanchez case, the court is saying, okay, look, if you as a pharmacy have something, and in that case it was a letter from the Nevada Task Force saying, you know, there's something suspicious about this particular customer's drug shopping or suspected drug shopping at various pharmacies. She's going to various pharmacies filling all these different medications. If a pharmacy has a letter like that in its records, and this touches upon the Clash case, if there's something that the pharmacy should know based upon its own record, a should have known standard, then we're dealing with the ifs proffered by Mr. Locke. If the pharmacy knows something about the customer being an addict or suspected addict, then it may have a duty to inquire. But there's absolutely no duty to inquire, and in fact, Garrigus and its progeny stands for the opposite proposition. It is not for the licensed pharmacist to second guess the licensed physician. There are two totally separate duties as it pertains between the medical practitioner, be it Mr. Armitage in this case, or a licensed physician who's prescribing that prescription or who's written that prescription, versus the training that a pharmacist might have in reading that prescription, understanding the dosage, and properly filling it. There was absolutely no dispute in this case that the prescription presented to the Walmart pharmacist was indeed valid on its face. There was nothing about it that should have triggered the pharmacist to, based upon its records or anything else, to second guess Mr. Armitage's.
Well, counsel, I think, said in his argument, clarified that there was the Walmart issue an OxyContin prescription was shortly before the methadone prescription.
That's right. So based upon that, unfortunately, the facts contradict that, because based upon that argument, therefore Smith should have been liable. Because in February 2005, Smith filled a methadone prescription and an OxyContin prescription for Mr. Kearns. And in March 2005, it was Walgreens Pharmacy that filled a methadone prescription for Mr. Kearns while he was also taking OxyContin.
But if the pharmacy, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, but my understanding is you can't prescribe OxyContin and methadone at the same time. You can't do it. You know, it has to be one or the other as far as for pain, because it's because the interaction can be fatal, you know, like that in doing that. So am I wrong on that?
Well, respectfully, yes. There's no law that provides that. That's an expert opinion proffered by...
I probably heard it in a case or something then like that, so you can clarify that.
Well, it's certainly the expert's opinion, and that's the Mr. Kearns family's position. That yes, looking at the fact that he had previously been prescribed OxyContin, then this particular prescription should have raised some red flag. However, that is not the case, one. But even if it were, there's nothing that says that the pharmacist can't take it on its face and say, this substitutes a previous prescription, and I'm relying upon the physician to have properly instructed his patient, his or her patient, to cease taking the previous prescription.
Okay.
And it was not a black box contraindication in it. There's nothing that indicates that those two could not be prescribed. So.
Absolutely nothing in the record that says that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. Physician's assistant Armiger diagnosed Mr. Kearns with addiction to OxyContin on the day that he wrote the prescription for methadone. The medical records make that clear. He knew that he was an addict, and he gave him the methadone prescription, and he gave him a plan to try to wean him off OxyContin and then wean him off methadone. So the suggestion that somehow he was only taking it for pain management is not accurate. Our position is that if you know someone's addicted to opiates, you can't just give them 120 pills and say good luck. Follow-up is needed.
This is a record. Is there anything in the record that indicates that the physician's assistant prescribed for something other than just pain management? Well, I mean, I know it's an inference you're making from the records.
He was diagnosed with the addiction, and that the expert report, the Levy report that was submitted, said that it was. I mean, afterward, I think that in his deposition testimony, he said it was for pain management, but it doesn't say that in his record. The diagnosis that he wrote the prescription for that day is for addiction to OxyContin. So at least there's a tribal issue of fact if the diagnosis is for addiction to OxyContin, what the purpose of the methadone was. I haven't heard anything with respect to superseding cause. No one seems to dispute that if you know someone is an addict, it is foreseeable that the addict may overdose if you give them 120 pills and tell them to manage on their own. There has been no...
Well, how do you treat, I'm sure there's people in doctor's offices today getting OxyContin prescriptions that are addicts, like that. What do the doctors do in quantity?
If
they really have real pain issues, do they go into the doctor's office or every day or something? Or how do you... That's why I asked Mr. Cotton, what's the proper amount to hand out to somebody?
I don't know that if you're treating someone for addiction, that it may be that it can't be done on an outpatient basis. It may have to be done inpatient under supervision. Methadone can only legally be prescribed for addiction management on a daily liquid form. Just can't give someone the pills.
I know that for if you're in a methadone clinic. We know that. The question is methadone for pain treatment can be given exactly like it was given here, though.
Perhaps, but here the diagnosis was for OxyContin addiction, and then you're giving someone this other opiate. In addition, there was testimony that Dr. Levy's report said it was very clearly that, and the prescribing information for methadone is that it's contraindicated if you have asthma, and that's in the Levy report. The 42 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 8.12, says that methadone products, when used for the treatment of opiate addiction, shall be dispensed only by certified treatment programs and only in oral form according with federal standards. So even under a learned intermediary standard, that doesn't mean that that where there is a independent federal regulation that regulates what pharmacies can do that they don't have a duty of inquiry to make sure that they're complying with the federal rule. And neither the medical nor the pharmacy defendants have taken issue with anything in the expert declarations reports that we submitted, the Gailey Declaration or the McKenzie Declaration about the pharmacy, about the rules that apply to pharmacies and what they can and cannot do. There's been, with respect to assumption of risk, counsel said there was no evidence post-mortem that Mr. Kearns had other drugs in his system other than methadone. That seems to me to totally undercut the idea that the assumption of risk based on doctor shopping and getting other drugs. The pharmacy defendants sort of have a comprehensive discussion in their brief about every prescription he filled in Nevada, and including where he got the methadone. There's no evidence that he got the methadone from his father or from doctor shopping. The only evidence in this whole report that is submitted is that he got the methadone that killed him from the prescription that was given to him by Desert Trails and filled by the pharmacy defense.
I have a question on the requirement of expert proof against the doctor defendant as to causation. Please walk me through your argument on how you demonstrate to a reasonable degree of medical probability that these injuries were caused by the writing of that prescription by Desert Trails.
The report of Dr. Giortani issued, he said that to a reasonable degree of probability, medical probability, based on his expertise, training, and what he saw, all of the facts, that he died, including the post-mortem diagnosis that he had methadone in his system, and the other facts, the dosage that was prescribed. There's evidence from also the Levy Declaration that it was the wrong dosage, that physician's assistant Armitage gave him a too high a dose. So you have the wrong dose, you have contraindication.
But that's failing. That's a standard of care issue. I'm interested in that our statutes require expert proof of causation, that the shortfall on the standard of care to a reasonable degree of medical certainty caused the injury. So as I read their argument, they're saying that your doctor's report, may I go on?
Oh, absolutely.
Your doctor's report may have gotten you through, but in deposition, the expert qualified his opinions to the point that you have a gap in the expert proof of causation. That's their argument, and I wanted to understand your rehabilitation of your expert on that point and why it's enough for past summary judgment.
I think that we don't believe that the deposition testimony, that Dr. Giortani's explanation, that the fact that a post-mortem
you can't do retrograde extrapolation, in essence, on that.
Right, doesn't show the dosage. I think the argument is that you know, you either have two options. You either took the therapeutic dose, and that was enough. Dr. Giortani thought the therapeutic dose was enough to cause him to go into respiratory failure, or he overdosed, and that would have been negligent, too. So under either of the two options, you still get to go to the jury on the issue of whether, under his declaration. I don't think he backed off in his report. I mean, he was aware when he issued the report, when he wrote the report, of all the information. It wasn't that he
was presenting. So methadone caused death, and it was inappropriate, in essence, to have ever written that prescription in that quantity for this man.
For this man, exactly,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you for your
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Panel thanks all three attorneys for their arguments in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.